You don't know Flag. You don't know Flag.
Welcome to You Don't Know Flag, a podcast full of stories about retro gaming, retro computing, video games, arcade games, and technology from a guy who was there and still is. My name is Rob O'Hara, but for the next 30 minutes, you can call me Flack.
Episode 7. How to Write a Book.
Hello, and welcome to episode 107 of You Don't Know Flack. You may have noticed that there was a significant break between episodes 106 and 107, and the reason for that break is I've been busy putting the finishing touches on my second book, which is entitled Invading Spaces, A Beginner's Guide to Collecting Arcade Games. Those of you that have listened to some of my previous podcasts or checked out my website or know me online know that I am a big fan of arcade cabinets, arcade machines, the big stand-up ones, and I have I currently own approximately 25. I always have to say approximately or about whenever I give a number because I'm always buying and selling machines. So right now it's right around 25. I just actually sold a couple of machines a week or so ago. But anyway, I've finished the book, and the book is going to debut on August 9th at the Oklahoma Video Game Expo in Tulsa, Oklahoma, OVGE. This is the fifth, do you say annual if you skipped a year? I think it's the fifth annual OVGE. They didn't have one last year, but OVGE is back, and I think OVGE is actually going to be huge this year since there is no Classic Gaming Expo, CGE, which is another one of the big shows, and I think a lot of people, I don't know that a lot of people are going to cancel their Vegas vacation plans to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, but I know a lot of the people here in the Midwest are going to attend the show. That, you know, people that may have had to decide in the past of going to one or the other, this makes it a little bit easier. But anyway, so I'm going to be at the show on August 9th, and I'm going to be selling both of my books, Commodork, Sordid Tales from a BBS Junkie, my first book, and I'll also be selling the new book, Invading Spaces, and I'll be signing those, and I'm going to be demonstrating some stuff. I haven't really decided what I'm going to have at the tables yet, but I'm sure there will be something Commodore related next to the Commodore books and something arcade related next to the arcade books. So I'm going to have to, you know what I would really like to do? I love when I get it off track in the first 5 minutes of the podcast, but I saw there was a video game museum somewhere in St. Louis, and it's closed several years ago, but I've seen pictures of this, a Ms. Pac-Man arcade machine that was completely built out of plexiglass, and I thought that was so cool. I didn't see it in person, but I've seen pictures of it on the web, and I thought, well, you know, what a neat thing, because people can see all the insides of an arcade game, you know. So, well, actually, one thing I've been thinking about doing, originally what I wanted to do is disassemble an arcade machine and have it working, but on the table, like have all the parts, you know, laying out on the table, but the problem with that is the 20 to 30,000 volts that go to a monitor and having that exposed, and so, you know, since there'd be such a, you know, risk of shocking children to death or whatever, I thought that might not be a good idea. So right now I'm considering actually just having a disassembled machine, but not having it turned on. But anyway, this is the last podcast before OVGE. And so, and it's the last podcast before the book goes on sale. So I really wanted to have a topic this time that had to do something with the book, you know. But, you know, I just did a podcast about my old arcade stories. So I didn't want to do that. And I really didn't want to just, you know, read stories from the book or talk about, you know, the book or whatever. So I was having dinner with a friend of mine the other day, and he suggested that I talk about actually writing the book and writing both of my books and how that came about and stuff. And I, you know, I've had several friends of mine online who've asked me, you know, well, how did your books come about? How did you write it? And, you know, ask me different types of questions, technical questions and general questions, you know. And so I thought, you know, that's a good idea. So the topic of this week's podcast is how to write a book. And so I'm just going to be talking about basically how the two books came together. Now, the next podcast on, which I'm going to try and stick a little bit stricter to my release schedule, but the next one will be, I'm still doing them every 2 weeks in theory. So on August 15th, I'm probably going to do a show about gaming conventions. You know, that will be right after the OVGE, and I've gone to OVGE and CGE and several different shows around. So I'll probably be talking about that. I've actually considered doing part of the podcast or something from the show, but I haven't really figured out the logistics of that. And I think it would probably be the logistics of getting, you know, decent sound quality or whatever. I'm not sure how that would work out. So, but probably after that, I'll be talking about that. And I've got two or three other shows already scripted out. One talking about some of the new things that have come out for Commodore computers, and I have one about Computer Copy Fest. And it's funny because I actually originally advertised the podcast as being about retro gaming, and I haven't done a single episode about old video game consoles, so I need to fit one of those in somewhere. So anyway, I've got a lot of material saved up, a lot of stuff to keep the shows going, so that's good. There's no shortage of material right now. So anyway, we're going to go ahead and get started with episode 107, which is titled How to Write a Book. When you publish a book, and whether that's through, you know, self-publishing like what I did, or a real publisher, or whatever, there's something magic that happens that people consider you to be an author. And that's kind of a weird position for me to be in because, you know, I didn't really think of myself as an author for a while. I just thought of myself as a guy that put a book out, you know. And it turns out there are a lot of people out there, whenever you do something like write a book or record music or, you know, anything that other people, a good way to say it would be like that other people have that same goal. Like there are a lot of people out there who would like to do music or a lot of people out there who would like to write a book. And so those people come to you and they have questions, you know. And so it was kind of weird for me in the beginning to field these questions as an author, you know. And in fact, when Commodore came out, you know, I had several people say, you know, as an author, what do you think about? And, you know, as they're saying their question, I'm just thinking, wow, am I an author? Like, how did that happen, you know? And so I thought I'd go back and talk a little bit about my first book. My first book, as I already mentioned, was called Commodork, Sorted Tales from a BBS Junkie, or just Commodork. And Commodork was, for those of you that haven't read it, is a collection of all my old BBS stories. Now, I was born in 1973. We got our first computer, TRS-80, in 1980. TRS-80 Model 3 in 1980. And so, pretty early on, we actually had a modem for our TRS-80 Model 3, but I didn't really get into modem shortly after the TRS-80. And I've already told this history previously, but we got an Apple II, and then from the Apple II, my dad moved to the IBM, and I moved to the Commodore 64, and we both had modems. So that's, you know, I mean, I grew up basically calling BBSs. So, you know, a lot of my stories, well, a lot of the stories do have to do about computer-type things or whatever, but a lot of the stories are just normal, like, coming-of-age type stories that just happen to involve a modem or involve computers because that's where I grew up. I grew up doing that, you know. I mean, if you grew up maybe playing sports or something, I'm sure you have a lot of funny stories or interesting stories that involve sports just because that's where you spent your time, you know. So when people talk about their childhood or when I talk about growing up, a lot of those stories involve computers, you know, and people that I met through the computer or, you know, things like that. So now, in the introduction of Commodork, one of the things I explain is I make this analogy between old disks losing data and my brain losing data, and both of those are very real events. And, you know, I still play with a real Commodore 64 all the time, but, you know, not every day. Like, sometimes it'll go into storage, and then I'll pull everything out, and then, you know, I'll play with it for a while, and then it goes back into storage, and I'll lose interest for a while, and then I pull everything back out. And one of the things I noticed is that every time I did this, I started finding more and more of my old floppy disks were developing disk errors. And so a lot of times when I write, and I do this, I mean, on my blog entries or when I'm just writing, I tend to make a lot of analogies. You know, I'll just notice that two things, you know, have something in common. It maybe not on the surface, but in my mind, there's these parallels. And so at around the same time, one of the things that I noticed that was just kind of funny was I was telling a story to my wife about, you know, an old Commodore story, and I had mentioned these two friends were both in the story. The way I told the story is like person A and person B and myself had all gone somewhere. And then when I started thinking about it, I realized that person A has never met person B. Like, person A moved before I ever met person B. So there's no way that these two people could possibly have been at the same place in the same time. But over the years, maybe there were two different stories that were similar or somehow, but somehow my brain has merged these two different stories and these two people into being at the same place at the same time, which if I go back and look, you know, like I said, looking at the facts, I know that that's not a possibility. And so it was kind of around the same time that I noticed that and that I noticed my discs failing. And so that kind of became the reason for writing the book. And so I made this little parallel and I said, you know, as I've noticed that the discs are getting older and failing and losing their data, so am I. I am also getting older and losing data. Commodore didn't start out actually to be a book at all. It just started out to be a collection of all my old stories because, like I said, you know, I realized this, that I was starting to get things wrong and get things mixed up. So I really wanted to document all these things. And it's an interesting thing to think about, like, you know, the Declaration of Independence. That was a big deal. And there are people who documented what happened that day. Or, you know, if you think about this, you know, the Space Shuttle Challenger or, you know, different just historical events get documented because people say, oh, this is important. And they, you know, there are enough people around and people write down and you have all these different views. But if in your own history, there's no one really doing that. And so if anybody's going to capture your own history, it has to be you. And so I realized that this history was kind of getting left behind, you know. So I started documenting all these old stories, and a lot of them were there was like a different types of stories. Like some of them would be like, you know, personal anecdotes, like, you know, this happened to me one time and it was funny, and so I would write that down. But other ones were more historical, like, you know, everybody was moving towards 2400 baud, or everybody started getting hard drives, you know. And so it was easy to mix these two types of stories together. I decided very early on that I was going to write Commodore chronologically. And so everything that happened in the book would happen, you know, in order of real life. And that actually became very difficult. And there are times, certain points in Commodore where I broke my own rule a few times. Like there would be, I know that there's one part that I really had a hard time with where I had introduced a friend of mine in a story, and then in reality I hadn't actually met him until later in the book, you know. And I think that may still be in there. It's kind of a chronological error that you know, you're talking about somebody before I've actually met him. But anyway, so when I started putting all this together, I didn't know what I was going to do with all these stories. I mean, I had this need to write them down and to document and capture these stories, but I didn't think anybody would be interested in my story. That's a big problem. If you're going to write a book, you have to come up with an angle that people that don't know you will be interested in. Two people, when I first started writing Commodore, I thought, you know, this is a personal story of funny anecdotes. I mean, I write Funny stories. I write funny anecdotes, and I have a good way of putting things together. But the two people that I've read about or listened to or seen are Bill Cosby and Will Rogers, and these are both people that are known for their funny story telling abilities. And so when I was writing my book, I kind of kept those people in mind. But the problem I was having is, people go to see Bill Cosby, or would in back in the day would buy a Bill Cosby record because they heard his last record and he was funny, so they so he's a famous type person. The same thing with Will Rogers. When he would write a new book or have a list of a new book full of stories, people know who Will Rogers is, and so they know that it's going to be he's already an established person. So the hurdle I had to overcome was no one knew or still knows who Rob O'Hara is. So, I'm coming up with this list, but who wants to read about the life and times of Rob O'Hara? And, the answer is really nobody. I mean, that's not something I could market, And so, that's kind of why the book became, obviously Commodore is my story, and that's what it was advertised at. And in fact, I have received very few emails from people that didn't like the book, but the people who didn't like it or were disappointed in it were mostly people who bought it and didn't, do their homework or read about, my advertisement of what it was. And it was a story of my my experiences growing up with a Commodore computer. And and my experiences through or with BBSs or whatever. Like one email I got from somebody. Actually, there's one of the reviews on Amazon is really bad, and it says, it's all this is this kid's stories about being on a BBS, and I'm like, exactly. That's exactly what the book is. That's what I advertise it as being. It's not a complete history of the Commodore computer. If you want that, pick up On the Edge, which is a great book, but it's not my story, and that's what I was trying to capture. But anyway, I knew that people wouldn't buy the story of Rob O'Hara, so that's why I started putting in, this whole timeline of modeming, and then I hung my story on that timeline, And so I'm writing all these stories, but I didn't, and I'm piecing it together chronologically, and I'll get into the technical aspect of how I did that in just a minute. But the turning point for me was Jason Scott's BBS documentary. And if you have any interest at all in computers or BBSs or technological documentaries, anything like that, you should really pick up Jason Scott's BBS documentary. I think it's $40, and it's it's like 6 hours worth of documentaries. It's all, I think it might even be longer than that. It's really fascinating. So I was probably 2/3 the way through with Commodore, and I wasn't really working on it that much at that time, because I didn't really see a purpose for it. I wanted to do it, but I didn't think it would sell. And then I found Jason's BBS documentary, and I was like, holy crap, there are people that are interested in, BBS stuff still. And so that kind of gave me the push. And I had done all this work on Commodore before I ever saw his BBS documentary, and I was really afraid that people would think that I had taken my book and just kind of jumped on his bandwagon or whatever. But so I got ordered his DVDs, and when I watched the BBS documentary, what was fascinating about it was that we had taken almost completely opposite approaches on talking about BBSs, because if you've seen the DVD, he's interviewed like over 200 people, and he gets 200 people's stories about BBSs, and he pieces them all together, and through these 200 interviews, he weaves like one basic history of BBSs, so he talks to if you think about the way I described it is like an inverted pyramid. Like at the top, it's really wide. Like he has these 200 interviews, and it funnels down to a point of, you know, one story, which is the history of BBSs. And my book is completely opposite. It's upside down. It's at the top of the pyramid, you know, it's just the one point. It's me and it's my story. And then that spreads out to the bottom of the pyramid and it's very wide. And that's, you know, the story of the BBS, but it's from one person's point of view. So, you know, his documentary, when he talks about, you know, the hacking scene or something, and he interviews, you know, 50 different hackers, and they all tell little bits of how, you know, what they did and how it related to BBSs. Where in my book, it's just like my little experience, like, well, here I am, and this is what I saw, and this is what people were doing, you know. So, and one of the things I have absolutely loved about Commodork is how many people have emailed me and said, I read your book, and it's like you were telling my story. And I thought that was so cool because, not that I thought that anything I did was unique. I mean, obviously a lot of the stories in there only happened to me, you know, I mean the people and the specifics and stuff, but here I am, you know, in the middle of, suburban Oklahoma, and, you know, I get emails from people in other countries, Canada and, Mexico and, you know, all these different countries, a lot in Germany, and they're like, you know what, it's, we were doing the exact same thing at the exact same time, you know, it's like, you know, actually I've had people say, you know, it's amazing that we didn't run into each other. And of course that was one of the funny things about BBSs is, you know, they were so localized that, obviously there were all these little different pockets that were all kind of evolving at the same time, but nobody was talking to each other. So to backtrack a little bit, whenever I saw Jason's DVD for the BBS documentary, I was like, you know what, there's an interest for this. And so that was kind of like when the picture came together for me, like, well, that's my approach, is that I'm kind of telling the story of, I mean, BBSs from start to finish, from my own eyes, you know, from one person's point of view. And so that was kind of how I molded the book together. And so it became a story that was, I mean, a book with a point that was more than just Rob O'Hara's stories. It was, you know, one guy's view of BBSs. And so, in fact, one thing that was hard for me was once I had decided on that, that gives me a beginning and an ending. I mean, that sets the beginning of the book has to be when I first get a computer and a modem, which is, I mean, really where the story begins. So that wasn't the problem. But the problem became is I had a lot of stories that continued on past the end of BBSs. And so when you have set up your book to be, you know, your story of calling BBSs, then that's where you have to end the book. And so so I had stories that, you know, like one of the people I mentioned in the book, Arcane, his name is Justin. He's a good friend of mine. He's still a good friend of mine. And I met Justin through the BBSs, and we had a lot of good times through BBSs. And then, you know, ultimately, we quit doing BBSs, and then we started doing things together on the internet. And so it was the same person, and I still had really funny and good stories about that person, but, you know, it didn't really fit what I had set up the book to be. So, you know, maybe that leaves, room for, Commodore Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. That'll be the title for book number 2. So anyway, one of the technical questions I get from a lot of people is how did you write your book? You know, I mean, like the technical part, because writing a book seems like such a, I mean, Commodork is 180 something pages, you know, and people are you know, how do you sit down and do that? And I'll tell you exactly how I did it was I used 3x5 note cards, like actual physical cards, which goes against everything that I stand for. I'm such a digital type person. I don't like post-it notes. I run, actually run Freenote on my computer, which is a freeware post-it note thing. So I have virtual post-it notes on my monitor. When I have to take a note, I type it into my phone. I don't, you know, I'm very electronic. I'm anti-paper. So, you know, to tell people that I use 3x5 cards is kind of embarrassing, especially when you're writing a book about computers. But that's what I did. I, I started writing down all my little stories, like, you know, blah, 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 CopyFest. And I would, you know, write down, not the whole story, but I would write down enough on this index card, you know, to remind me what the story was. And I sat down one day and I sat down with, you know, I came up with every story idea and all these different, you know, every part of the book, basically. And I wrote them all down and I put them out on my kitchen table. And then I had this huge, you know, stack of 3x5 index cards. And then I kind of started moving them around and grouping them into like subjects, you know. And, well, along those same lines, I also arranged them chronologically. So this happened, then this happened, you know. And so I move all these index cards around. And then you started seeing, you know, like, okay, well, these stories all involve Justin. Or these stories all involved, you know, copy fests. And so it was pretty easy for me anyway, the physical action of moving these cards around and grouping stuff. I didn't actually do that with Invading Spaces, the second book, but you know, the first project being you know, it was just an easy way to help me organize stuff and move stuff around. So that's actually what I did. And then once I got those, you know, basic concepts of like, okay, chapter 3 is going to be about this, chapter 5 is going to be this, and it's going to have these 10 stories. Then I took all those things and I did write them in Notepad. And then, you know, as I needed to add or remove, you know, stories or rearrange things or whatever, then I could just cut, paste them and move around Notepad. But that's how I actually organized everything for the first time. So, you know, ultimately I came up with a book, and I don't have a lot of regrets over Commodore, but if I have one regret, actually I kind of have two regrets, I guess, if I had to come up with one. And one was one regret I have, which is really a minor one, is some of the pictures. And you know, when I did Commodore, I thought that this may be the only book I ever write. And so there were certain pictures that I just included, that were kind of stupid and didn't really have much to do with the book. But I thought, you know, if I only do one book, I really want to see a picture of me and the stranger in the front row of WWE, which is on the last page of the book. And it has nothing to do, I mean, you know, the stranger, is obviously, you know, mentioned throughout the book. So, that's, you know, it's not like it's there for no reason, but it's, I'm sure when people go, they go, what the hell is this picture in here for? But, you know, if you have that fear that you're only going to do one book, you want to include everything, you know, so that's why that's in there. But, so I would have, taken some of the pictures out. And, but really that goes with my big regret with that book. And that is, I did not use, an editor. I edited the book myself, and editing was a problem for me. And I did have the stranger and my wife, and it seems like maybe one or two other people. But once you write a book, my dad mentioned something to me while he was looking at Invading Spaces, and he said the types of errors that you make most commonly when you're writing are the same types of errors that you'll miss when you're, you know, copy editing or proofreading. And that's very true. So it really helps. I mean, the two best ways to copy edit something, one is to totally walk away from it. And, I can't tell you on Invading Spaces how many times I rewrote the first chapter, because I would write it and write it and write it. And you know, you get it to where you really like it, and then I would go work on something else, and the next day I would go look at it, and I would move things around again and cut parts out and add parts. So that fresh set of eyes helps. But to have somebody who's not familiar with the book at all to look at it, that's really your one of your greatest assets, you know. And so when I wrote Commodore, I did the exact same thing with Invading Spaces, unfortunately, and it was, I had it down to the last day. Like, I had to send it off on such and such a day to ensure that I would have copies back so that I could take them to OVGE and sell them. And I cut it very, very close. I cut it close with both shows, actually. Actually, with Invading Spaces, I I paid a lot of extra money for priority shipping to ensure that I'll have books at the show. And so I do have books now. They're not for sale yet, but I do have books on hand. But, you know, you get to the point where you're at the very end and you're, you know, pressed for time. And the ultimate solution would be to finish your thing and then send it off maybe to a professional publisher even would be nice. But if you don't want that, there are people out there that will read your book for free. But what I ran into with Commodore was a lot of people offered to read my book, and then most of those people did not read the book. Or they skimmed it, or, you know, they wanted to see the book, but they did not want to read the book and give me feedback on the book. So that was a big problem with Commodore was I think I sent out 10 PDF copies, and I heard back from 2 or 3 people. So there are errors in Commodore. Now, here's and I'm going to be talking about Lulu, which is the publisher that I use here, in just a few minutes. But Lulu is actually a print-on-demand book printing service. And they are an online publisher. And the way that they work is that you write your book, you upload it to Lulu, and then you order your books, back through them. And they make a certain amount off of each book. And the more books that you buy, you get a discount, you know. So I'm going to talk about that shortly. But the good thing about that is with Commodore, when I ordered my first batch, I ordered about, I think it was 25 books. And when I got it, I was just horrified at how many, there weren't a lot, but there were a lot for me. I mean, there were probably 15 or 20 errors that I found. And it's amazing that you could stare at something at a screen forever and not see them. And the minute it's on printed paper and you look at it, they just jump out at you. And the other problem was the template that Lulu offered for their covers had they made a really big deal and said, don't put anything in the right 2 inches or something like that. Like, this is our trim area. And so I put everything on the left side, and as a result, the front covers were slightly off center. I mean, it wasn't slightly, it was like an inch off center. I mean, the picture I sent was large enough that it covered the whole front cover, thank goodness, but it was off center and it really bothered me. And a lot of people didn't notice, you know, but you know how it is. It's something you create, you're absolutely going to notice. So, ideally, the way that you would do it is proofread, have other people proofread, edit it, take their suggestions and their corrections, implement all those, and when you're done, send it, your manuscript, if you want to call it that, into Lulu, get one copy, and then look at that copy and make sure that there are no errors or whatever, and then if that copy looks okay, then order, however many copies you think you can sell or whatever. But I didn't have time to do that either time. Fortunately, on Invading Spaces, I've gone through the print copy, and I only found one error, which was, it's not a big one. I think it's like the word "and" is missing, instead of a comma or something like that. But, on Commodore, I ordered those first 25 copies, and then, I look at them, and they're awful, and then I hated it, and I had to sell those, I did, So, there's 25 lucky people out there that have the limited edition error-filled copies of Commodore. So if you have... Actually, the first 25 were all numbered. I numbered all 25 when I signed the first one. So if you have one of those, lucky you. Maybe you can sell it someday. But anyway, so I've already started talking about Lulu. So Lulu is, like I said, what they call a print-on-demand, which is you can order one book at a time. You place an order with Lulu. They print, bind, collate your book or whatever, and then they send it back to you. But they don't make it until you place an order. So there is kind of a delay there. Now, this one of the big questions that I have is a lot of people want to know about money. And I never know if it's rude to talk about money, or I have weird concepts about talking about money. And I talk about it too much, actually. But whenever you upload when it, okay, so if you've written your book and Lulu accepts, basically they print their books in PDF format. Now let me say this at the very beginning. I don't endorse Lulu.com more or less than any other person. I mean, I don't, I'm not saying that they're the best or the greatest or anything like that. All I can say is that that's who I've used the last two times. So that's why I'm talking about Lulu.com. If you know of another print-on-demand publisher or anything like that, the problem with print-on-demand is there are a lot of places that rip you off. They want your money up front and everything else like that, and Lulu.com is not a scam. So I can't vouch for them in that aspect, that it's been really good to work with them. So the way it works is you write your document and Microsoft Word is accepted. I would think that would be the most common. You can also generate your own PDF if you want, but it's fairly complicated to do. It's not just, they won't accept just any PDF. There are a lot of rules and stuff. But online they do have Microsoft Word templates, so you can just download a template and they have it sized for, like, I've printed them. My books are a 6x9 format, so they have different templates for their sizes or whatever. So once you're done with your Word template, you go and you upload it to Lulu. They convert it to a PDF, and then they send it right back to you, and you get an opportunity to look at it. You know, so you could go through it and make sure everything formatted right. I have had slight differences in font sizes or whatever, so it's good to go through and look at that PDF and make sure that, you know, everything looks okay. Once you approve that, then that goes on file on your Lulu account. And then you have several different options. Like, you can design your own cover, which I've done my own cover both times. And, oh man, this last time was such a pain in the butt because it has to be 300 DPI. And I made the mistake of doing my cover in Photoshop and used the default of 72 DPI. And so I had to go through a whole thing of resampling and resizing. It literally took hours to, you know, resample this picture up to 300 DPI. And in the end, I couldn't tell a difference, but I suppose, you know, on something that you print, you know, you can probably tell a difference. But anyway, so you design your cover, or if you don't want to design your own cover, they have hundreds of templates that you can just use their templates and put your own text, like, on their pictures and stuff like that. So you can do that too. In fact, a friend of mine, well, The Stranger, that's what he's done with his books. So once you do that, then they basically have an electronic version of your book online, and you now have several options. The way that Lulu makes their money is they have a set fee that you pay for each book that is printed, and then on top of that, they take 1/5 of the profits. So I believe, I'm rounding here, and so I'm going to be rounding some numbers for these examples, but I believe on Commodore, that the setup fee was about $4 per book. Okay. And I sell Commodore for $15. So people go, wow, you're making this $11 per book. Well, first of all, of that $11, Lulu takes a fifth of it. So they take another $2 or whatever that is, $2 and some change. So they keep that, and I make 80%. So I'm going to make, you know, the $8 or whatever off that, which is really good. You would be really hard-pressed to get a book deal anywhere that's going to pay you that kind of, especially for a first-time author. Now, you know, it sounds kind of greedy. Like, you know, why am I selling it for $15? Well, the reason for that is that when people buy it through... If you buy it through Lulu electronically, then they take another chunk of that money, and you make a little bit less off that. And I want to say that was another, like, $3 handling fee or something to that effect. Now, where the real problem comes in is if you want to sell your book through Amazon.com, and I absolutely did with Commodore. I didn't think it was a real book unless you could get it through Amazon. I mean, everybody's on Amazon, and I had to have my book there. So to get your book on Amazon through Lulu, first of all, you have to purchase a ISBN number. And which I did, and that's $99. So you add $100 to your, you know, cost. Now, I should mention this real quick, is that if all you do is have people buy their, you know, if you just sell your book through Lulu, you don't have to pay any money ever. They keep, you know, their percentage, and you set your PayPal account up, and, you know, once a month they deposit your profits into your PayPal account. So you don't have to. That's one thing really to watch out for a lot of these print-on-demand type places. If they ask for a lot of money up front, then, you know, you might want to consider or reconsider doing business with them. But so your book is on file, and when people buy it, you know, it, they just drops the profits into your PayPal account. So that's nice. But if you wanted to do it through Amazon, they have a whole thing, and it's still hands-off for you. So your book, after you get this number, and they say that they put you into, like, I think it's like 13 different online book resellers. Like, it goes into Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and Borders.com. So all the big online book retailers. And actually, it goes into a lot more than that. In fact, Steven just pointed out the other day that he found someone selling 100 copies of Commodore on eBay. And, you know, so it's once that you're in the system, then people just find your book and they sell it or resell it or whatever. So, so Commodore, you can buy lots and lots of places, but, Amazon has a handling fee of like another $4 or something. And so, I mean, on one end of the spectrum is, I have the ability to buy my own book. And in fact, when I buy my own book, all you pay is that setup fee. You don't pay Lulu, you know, any of the 20% of the profit. They cut the whole profit thing off, and I just pay the setup fee. And it's more than $4. I think, copies of Commodore cost me, if I buy one, it was like $7, something like that. And then they have discounts if you buy multiple books. If I buy like 50 copies, I think I only pay like $5 a copy, something to that effect. But if you buy a copy from Amazon, number one, Lulu takes that $7, then they take their 20%, then they take their handling fee, then it goes to Amazon, and Amazon takes their handling fee. So if you buy a copy of Commodore from Amazon.com, I make 88 cents. And that, I mean, that's the exact number, because I've seen the PayPal transactions. And then if you're doing it through PayPal, don't forget that PayPal is going to take their part off of that 88% for their handling fee. If you're, you know, if you're set up to do credit cards, it's the however much, whatever it is, the 30 cents or the 3% or whatever. So, you know, I barely break even. I mean, I can't say I lose money on doing Amazon, but, you know, so there's a lot of people that have found the book on Amazon and they bought it, and they, you know, they see that it's a small author and that they buy it, but, you know, really it's not helping me. It's making Amazon a lot of money. But anyway, you know, if you're self-publishing a book, I think I've sold somewhere between 500 and 600 copies of Commodore. So obviously, you know, I'm not getting rich off of, writing and self-publishing books. And that's, something that you really have to come to terms with. And there's several things that I waver back and forth on. One of them is the money issue. You know, I've thought about, I thought about with Invading Spaces, trying to send it to, I really wanted to go through, Rolenta Press. And there were a couple other publishers I was looking at, but ultimately, you know, financially I could probably make just as much money self-publishing it. But then you get into the argument of, is it really about the money? Which, you know, for me, it's not. I mean, not for Commodore, obviously. You know, there's not a book about, you know, an Oklahoma nerd's BBS memoirs is not going to be on the bestsellers list. I'm not going to retire off that book. So, you know, one thing you have to decide is, you know, if you want to try to go with a real publisher, if you could get picked up, you know, there's a lot of book deals out there anywhere for first time authors, you know, for $1,000, $3,000, maybe even $5,000, you know, if you can find a publisher that's interested in your book. Then the way that those work is, like, if you get $1,000 advance, then you make some sort of agreement, like you make $2 per book or something, and you start getting paid once that advance is paid off. So, you know, it's 6-in-1. It's just a different way to do it. But so my whole idea through self-publishing through Lulu was with Commodore was that way I would have a book. I could tell people that I've written a book and put a book out, and you know, then possibly with the second book, then I could actually pursue being published, you know. But what I actually found out is that there aren't really very many big publishers that are interested in nonfiction, computer-related type things. I mean, you have O'Reilly, and you have, I mean, don't get me wrong, they're out there, but what I'm trying to say is I couldn't find anybody interested in mine. So I had such a fun experience doing Commodore self-publishing that I just decided that I was going to, that was what I knew, and that I was going to do that with Invading Spaces. So anyway, moving forward, at OVGE 2006 is where I started selling Commodore. And I had those first 25 copies, and I was so worried that I was going to sell out. And what was I going to do when I sold out or whatever? And I think I sold 15 copies, and probably 10 of those were to people I knew. So all of a sudden, I was like, wow, this didn't go as well as I thought it was going to, you know. And so that kind of brings us to promotion. Now, when you write a book with a publisher, basically your job is to write the book, and they have someone who edits the book, and they'll have someone who designs the cover, and ultimately they'll have someone who promotes your book. When you self-publish a book, you are all those things. You are the writer, you are the designer, the layout, you're the editor. You know, like I said, you may let someone else edit it, but ultimately you're the proofreader. And when that product comes back, you're the promoter. And so you have to find ways of getting your book out, you know, to the public. Now, for video game books, I had a, well, you know, for Commodore and Invading Spaces, I had a built-in audience of, the computer forums, the online forums that I'm a member of, like Digital Press and Atari Age and, Lemon 64 and all these places that I hang out at online that I had, you know, a good reputation at. And so I didn't want to just like whore it out, you know, and be posting every week and be like, hey, I got a book, you know. I didn't want to do that, but I did think it was fair game to put a link to the book in my signature, you know, and I put a little graphic that said, you know, Commodore now available. And then I went to all these forums that I was a member of, and I even signed up for some forums that I wasn't a member of, and I would find any conversation that had anything to do with Commodores or BBSs or whatever, and I would join in those conversations. And I wouldn't, you know, be like, hey, if you like this, you should buy my book. I don't know why I have a stupid voice every time. I don't really talk like that. So, you know, I would join in these conversations, and then in my signature, I would have this thing. So it was kind of like a subtle advertising type thing. And I'm sure on each one of those forums, I did post one post that, you know, said, hey, you know, I have my book is for sale or whatever. But I mean, on Digital Press, gosh, I have something like 15,000 posts or 16,000 posts. So I've been there. I've been a really active member and stuff. So, you know, all of a sudden you have this link in your signature, and now, you know, if people go to Google and they type in, you know, they're searching for things, and they're going to run across your name or, you know, a conversation that you're having, and then they go there and they're going to see that link in your signature to the book, you know. So that was my first idea for promoting the book, and it didn't go very well. I mean, I may have sold another 10 or 12 copies or 15 copies maybe, but you know, think about all the ads that you see on the internet every day, and they're, you know, and even, I mean, probably 99% of them don't interest you. And even the ones you do, how many times have you said, oh, that's interesting, you know, but I'll have to buy that later when I have my wallet here and I have my credit card, or, you know, maybe I'll ask for that for Christmas or something, you know, but, you know, you don't, even if it looks interesting, you don't always buy it, you know. So all of a sudden I was like, man, you know, this isn't going well. And then Jason Scott came to my rescue. Now, Jason Scott, when he had released the BBS documentary, I was so excited about it that after watching it, I wrote a big review about it. It was a very positive, favorable review of the BBS documentary, and I posted it on my site and you know, all the sites that I was a member of. I know I sent it to, I think I actually wrote it for Earl Green's website, thelogbook.com. And he posted it, and then I emailed Jason Scott. I didn't know Jason Scott, but I emailed him and said, hey, here's a link, you know, to the review. I hope you find it, you know, favorable or whatever. So anyway, obviously he follows BBS things, and he found out about my book. And so it's kind of a case of scratching each other's backs, maybe, I don't know. But he found my book and wrote a review and submitted it, and it ended up appearing on Slashdot. I'm sure probably everybody listening to this knows what Slashdot is, but Slashdot is a really big technical site, and there are so many people, in fact, that hit Slashdot every day that whenever they link to a story, there's a phrase called being Slashdotted, which is when hundreds of thousands of people hit your website all at one time, and it tends to crash web servers. So, you know, if you can get your story or something like that listed on Slashdot, if your server can take the pounding, it's a really good advertising tool. And so Jason had written this book review for Commodore, and it got posted on Slashdot. And, you know, I was checking my website looking for sales, and all of a sudden I can't get to my website anymore because it's being pounded by thousands of Slashdot nerds, and which is a good thing. I don't want to make it sound like it's derogatory. And so up until that point, I want to say that was like late August, you know, maybe like a month after after I had originally sold the book. And prior to that point, I remember I had sold like around 30 copies of the book. That day, I sold over 100. And so that was really the thing that got the ball rolling for me. Because, you know, when all these people saw it, then all of a sudden it was like, you know, it got picked up by little news stories here and there. And I had, I always joke that I'm really big in Germany. I had two different German magazines contact me. I mean, I think they're online or PDF type zines, but they both contacted me and wanted to do interviews. And I did an interview with a different Earl from Retrobits podcast, and that's a great podcast. That's everything that this podcast should be, is Earl's podcast at Retrobits. His podcast is fantastic. But Earl actually did a interview with me over the cell phone, and he recorded it and did it on, you know, so it just getting on Slashdot, something like that. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, if you want to sell a book, get on Slashdot. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, you know, once you start getting the buzz, I'll tell you another regret that I have about Commodore, and something that I'm going to change on Invading Spaces. And I don't want a whole bunch of emails, everybody asking me for free books right now. But, you know, with Commodore, when I bought all these copies, all I had, I didn't have the big picture in mind. I just had this, like, you know, every book, I'm like, I just paid $7 for that. I must sell this for $15 and make my money back and cover all my other expenses and everything. And so I was very, very reluctant to give out press copies. In fact, who was it? Video Game Collector Magazine, Sean Paul Jones hit me up at OVGE and said, hey, if you give me a book, you know, I'll, you know, try and review it and I'll get it in the magazine. And I was like, nah, I can't, you know, if you buy one, you know, and I actually made him, you know, tried to get him to buy one and he didn't buy one. And I think, I mean, eventually he did buy one. But, you know, in retrospect, I would never do that. I would gladly give, you know, a magazine editor, owner, publisher, writer, whatever, a copy of the book. And, you know, I mean, whatever you lose in the actual paying of that book, you're going to get back, you know, in advertising and whatever. But so that's definitely something that I will change with this book, Invading Spaces, is... you know, if I find people that say, hey, will you send me a copy, you know, that are with a magazine, not you who's listening here right now thinking that you're going to get a free book. I'll definitely probably do more promo copies of the book. In fact, I just today I wrote out a press release and sent it out to some newspapers and stuff, and it looks like I might get some action off that. So promoting is like a full-time job. Jason... I know I keep talking about Jason Scott, but he's really taught me a lot about self-promotion, and it is really, a full-time job and a half. You know, I mean, you have to constantly be putting your product out there and talking to people. And I don't do it nearly enough. Once I sold, you know, X amount of copies or whatever. But, you know, when people, I've had a couple of people that have written books that say, you know, well, I haven't sold very many copies. Well, let me tell you, after I did, I mean, when Commodore came out, the first thing I did was went to OVGE. I set up a big table. I had a banner, a Commodore. I set up Commodore stuff so people that were interested in Commodores would come look. And then when they came, you know, I would say, oh, by the way, I wrote this book. You know, I should use my dumb voice. Oh, I wrote this book. And, you know, so you would get those people's attention. Then after that, a few months later was the ECCC. Yeah, three C's. ECCC, which was the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention. And I have family in Chicago, so I scheduled a family vacation, and I drove to Chicago, which is 800 miles from here, and I purchased a table, and I set up a table there and did a display and sold copies of Commodore, and I wore a t-shirt that my wife had made for me that said Commodore on it, you know, so... and then last year at CGE, I worked out a deal with Joe Santoli, the owner of Digital Press, and I sold copies of Commodore through there. And the following weekend was DEF CON, the hacker convention, which was also in Vegas. And Radman from Acid had a connection there, somebody that was selling a booth. And those people, that's like, I mean, Radman... I mean, he didn't know me anything. He's a friend of mine through Cult of the Dead Cow. I mean, I hate to call him a friend because that makes it sound like we're closer than we are. But I mean, I could consider him a friend. He's a super, super nice guy. And he actually hooked me up with somebody who would sell my book for me, and I didn't have to pay anything. I was so grateful for that. But you know, so when people say, "Well, hey, I wrote this book and it's not selling." Well, I was driving around the country, you know, setting up these different things and doing PR releases, you know, attending shows and trying to sell stuff like that. I was, schmoozing at CGE, you know, so it didn't just happen. I didn't sell 500 copies just because, you know, I wrote a book and stuck it out there. And like I said, 500 copies, there's a part of me that's proud that I sold that many. And there's another part that's really... kind of disappointed. I mean, I'd like to sell, you know, 5,000 copies, and maybe I will on Invading Spaces. You know, I learned a lot of how to promote and how to deal with people and stuff like that. And, so I'm sure I'll do more with Invading Spaces, but anyway, so, Commodore, I rode this wave for probably 6 months or so. It sold and then it tapered off, and I sell, you know, a couple of copies a month now, and not very many. But I also don't promote it very much. And so, you kind of fast forward a little bit, and I've been collecting arcade games for a long time, but I really picked up in 2003, and that was when my wife set up our backyard shed as a arcade for me. So I, you know, it kind of gave me the license to start collecting games. And so I did. And I started buying arcade games and fixing them up or trying to fix them up and, buying and selling and things like that. And so I kind of, like around Digital Press and some of these places, I kind of became like the resident arcade guy. I am by no means an expert, and everybody I know in the hobby knows more than I do about our, you know, arcade games and stuff, but I know where to look for information. And like I said, I have this way of organizing information that I think, people, they understand that. I mean, the way I write it is entertaining, and it's like I can kind of convey the information and stuff in an entertaining way, but also make it factual, you know? And so, like on Digital Press, I do a lot of, you know, answer a lot of arcade related questions for people. And so anyway, after a while, I was just writing the same things over and over and over. You know, people go online and say, you know, what's a super gun or what's JAMA? And then you're explaining this and you're like, how many times have I explained this before? And then, you know, when I started looking, it's like, there's not a book for beginners wanting to get into arcade collecting. It's, you know, there are, I mean, the closest thing I think that I found was the guy over at was John St. Clair over at arcadecontrols.com. You know, he has his book is about MAME cabinets, and it takes you through that whole process, but it doesn't talk, you know, about arcade game collecting. And there are books, there's price guides about arcades, and I found some things that were similar, but I didn't really find anything of what I wanted was when these people would come on the forum and say, you know, I'm interested in arcade collecting, but I don't know where to start. I wanted something that I could refer them to and say, you should read this, you know, and I never could find whatever this was, you know. And so, you know, just the idea, I was still kind of on the coattails of Commodore, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to write this. And so I sat down and I wrote up, you know, like I had done with Commodore, I didn't do the index cards, but I just went in Notepad and I was like, you know, well, if I were going to, explain the entire hobby of collecting arcade games, you know, what would that entail? And, you know, so I wrote down that would entail buying games. And then I had these little subheaders like, you know, buying from people, buying from Craigslist, buying from eBay, buying from, arcade auctions. So I had this whole thing of like buying games. And then I had a whole thing about moving games. And you know, I broke that down into three different types, like short range, medium range, and long range, where short range is like moving them around your house. Medium range would be like moving them across town. And long range is actually shipping them, you know. So every aspect of the hobby I kind of broke down and then broke down a little bit further. I had a section on flipping games, which, you know, like flip this house or whatever, like people who buy games, fix them up, restore them, convert them, whatever, and then sell them for a profit. And then, you know, I did do a chapter on MAME because I think you have to address arcade emulation if you're going to talk about arcade games. But Invading Spaces was actually, it was easier to write and harder to write in different aspects. It was easier to write because the chapters came together almost immediately. I mean, when you think about the hobby, there are only so many things that you're going to talk about, you know? So that part was easy. The hard part was Invading Spaces was more, I mean, I would say both books are nonfiction, but Commodore, I wrote most of Commodore without doing any research. Commodore was my old story, so all I had to do was sit down and think of old stories and write them down. Invading Spaces contains like a lot of facts, you know, like there's two chapters on repairs, one's on electronic repair, one's on actual physical repair, you know, and I mean, some of the repairs I have done, most of the repairs I have attempted, I guess I'll say that, but, you know, you want to, you know, make sure that you're giving good advice or that you're explaining something in a good way. So I actually had to do, you know, quite a bit of research for Invading Spaces, and that took a long time. And I don't know how you are, but it's really difficult for me to work on a project that requires the internet and then not get sidetracked. So, you know, it was very easy for me to go, you know, I need to look this up on an arcade site, and I would look up that fact, and then I would look up some more facts, and then I would notice that they had Flash arcade games, and then 3 hours later, I'm like, bro, I'm really good at Donkey Kong. And, the hardest thing for me is checking email. I mean, I have email on all the time, so the longest I've gone so far this month without checking my email, other than when I'm asleep, is right now while recording this podcast. So, you know, to be able to actually be online, but, you know, have the, what's the word I'm looking for? Not the determination, the discipline, really. You know, to have the discipline to be able to remain online, but just do what you're supposed to do, that was hard for me. And what I ended up doing, and I can't remember if I talked about it on the podcast. I know I posted about it on my blog, but I ended up taking a writing sabbatical, which is, you know, I have a wife and a job, and I have two kids, and it's difficult to set aside that time where you're just going to write. You know, it's very, if you have a family especially, it's very guilty feeling of, you know, life is going on outside your little room, and now I'm going to go in my room and shut the door, and I'm going to write, and nobody can bother me, you know, and it's hard to find that time to do that. Once I had, I got to a point where I just got stuck on the book. Like, I was, you know, maybe halfway done or whatever. It's hard to say percentages, too. I know Steven's giving me a hard time, and Susan kind of gave me a hard time about that too, because my percentages kept changing. But as you work on the book, your perception of where you are in the book changes. You know, like, you know, I wrote down all my ideas and I started on half the chapter. So I was like, well, I'm 50% done. But then when you go and actually start writing those, you're like, oh, I'm only 10% done. And you write and write and write, and you get to, you know, maybe halfway done, and you're like, wow, now I'm 50% done. And then, you know, people go, well, I thought you were 50% done before. But, you know, it's just because your perceptions change. And even when you're totally done with the book, you're like, wow, I'm totally done with the book. So that's 100%. But if you're talking about writing, that's 100%. But you haven't factored in, you know, designing your cover or having it proofread and edited and going through that. So are you really 100%? You know, so you can't get really dragged down on the numbers. But, you know, I got to a point where I was just having a hard time focusing on writing at home. And so I went and rented a cabin that was by a nearby lake. And I went to the cabin and I took my laptop and I took my MP3 player, and I didn't take much else. You know, I didn't want to get sidetracked. I did take the two things I took were, I took a DVD copy of Funny Farm, which is the dumb Chevy Chase movie where he goes to the woods to be a writer. And I watched it that night, you know, and I don't know. Well, two things. Number one is, for some reason, whenever I think about, you know, going away and writing, I always think about that movie. I haven't seen it in a long time, but you know, that's just what I thought about. Number two, after I watched it, I was like, wow, this is a really bad movie. But Chevy Chase made some terrible movie decisions. So that's what I thought after watching it. But you know, it was really good because I'm sitting in this, I actually got, you know, I think I did a Saturday or Sunday, Monday, or, golly, I don't remember what it was, but I had two full days at this, cabin, you know, and it was awesome. There was just no TV there. There were no interruptions. The other thing I took was, Bill Kunkel's book. Bill Kunkel, basically started video game journalism. He's the father, or some say the grandfather, of video game journalism. He was one of the founders of Electronic Games Magazine, and he wrote a lot of Electronic Games Magazine, and he's also known as the Game Doctor. And I had read most of his book before, but I finished it while I was out there, and just going through some of the stories, you know, I think my writing style is probably similar to his, in that you know, it's full of a lot of anecdotes, and I mean, sometimes the story is not the story, it's what leads up to the story. And he does a lot of the same things I do. So, you know, I skim through that. Whenever I was getting stuck on something, I would just read through that and kind of, you know, get back in the mood of gaming. You know, the other thing I should say is that I took is Andrew Hoffel's you know what? I'm drawing a blank of what the name is, and I'm going to look it up real quick. Andy Hoffel did the Arcade Ambience project page, and he did four different MP3s, and each one is right about the length of a blank CD. So if you want to burn an audio CD, it'll fit on there. And what it is basically, it is the sounds of an actual arcade. And he used MAME and emulation to actually to do the sounds. There's four different ones, and each one is like from a different era of the arcades. There's 1981, 1983, 1986, and 1992. And you could go to arcade.hoffle.com, and you could download these MP3s for free. And when you listen to them, I mean, there's no music in the background. There's like some crowd noise that's kind of simulated, you know. But really, it's like walking around an arcade. And you know, so when I was working on Invading Spaces and I'm sitting out in this lake cabin, you know, and I needed to get inspired, I put on these MP3s, and it was just all the old sounds of arcade games and stuff, you know, and it just kind of gets you back in the mood, you know, and make you kind of smile and think about old arcades and stuff like that. So anyway, I did listen to, Andy Hoffel's, Arcade Ambience, and, you know, anybody who likes arcade, in fact, you know, I have those tracks, and sometimes I'll put them on the stereo out in my arcade, like, you know, just for background noise or whatever. But I highly recommend you go to Andy's site, download those. And I think, you know, I'm going to look here real quick, but I think I don't even see a place on his website for a donation thing or whatever. But, you know, I mean, yeah, you should kick the guy a few bucks or whatever. I think it's a really cool project. So anyway, you know, so I finished up the book finally at, you know, the last minute. I went on vacation the week before last to Chicago, and I knew that I had to send the book in before I left. And so Sunday morning at 3 in the morning, I'm finishing up the book. You know, my wife proofread the book, and Steven proofread the book, and my dad, who worked at a printing company for 30 years as a foreman and who did spot check proofreading, he proofread the book. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure we got 99% of the errors out of it. Whatever got through there, the four of us missed it. And so, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there's one or two small things, but I think I did a lot better job. That was one of the things that really bugged me about Commodore. So I think I did a better job with that this time. And I know I'm going to do better, you know, promoting it and stuff like that. Originally, I said that you don't know Flacco's going to run half an hour. This one's well over an hour once again. Steven gives me a hard time every time. And so I'm sure I will not hear the end of this one either. But anyway, so I wanted to basically, I guess I'll kind of go through and recap. About writing a book and self-publishing it, you know, basically the first thing that I wanted to say was, you know, you have to have an idea for a book. If you're just, I mean, just because it's a book about you, that's not going to sell. You know, it has to be, there has to be some overall, you know, story. I mean, it could be full of your own stories, but it has to be, you know, a bigger picture or whatever. And once you have that, just start writing, write down all your ideas, find a way to organize it that makes sense. I mean, you know, Commodore was chronological. It was laid out in order. Invading Spaces was more. It was partially chronological. I mean, I had chapters. Obviously, you're going to talk about, I talk about, like, the terminology first, and then how to buy a game, and then later how to fix games, and then how to sell games. So, that, you know, it's just kind of a logical progression. And then, you know, one of the things people always ask me about, because Commodore is full of so many funny stories, is if I have the same thing in Invading Spaces, and I do. There's a lot of funny stories in Invading Spaces, but I had so many good arcade-related stories that wouldn't even fit, so I have a whole chapter at the end of Invading Spaces called Loose Change, which is just full of unrelated stories. I mean, they're related to arcade stories, but they're not related to one another. So once you have this thing written, you know, get it proofread, edited, get all the mistakes out of it, you know, do a professional job, have it look like an actual book, and then go sign up with lulu.com. That's who I've used. Upload your manuscript to them. You can also design your cover at that point. And they accept, you know, any kind of graphic uploads. It has to be 300 DPI, but they have templates. And I mean, I did mine in Photoshop, saved them as JPEGs and uploaded it, and they look great. And then once you do that, you can sign up for the ISBN number, and you can start selling. You only need that if you're going to sell through the online retailers other than Lulu. So you have three different selling options. You can buy copies yourself and sell them like through your website, or, you know, in person or promotions, things like that. You can sell them. You can refer people to Lulu, and people can buy your book through Lulu. Or you can sign up for the ISBN and then sell it through places like Amazon. And Commodore is available in all three of those places. Invading Spaces right now is just going to be available through me for the first. There's going to be a limited edition. There's also going to be a surprise included in the first 25 books that are going to be available at OVGE. I can't really tell you what that is yet. I mean, it's not a great surprise, like, you know, if you don't fly in for it, but I think people that pick it up there, you know, they'll get a kick out of it. But anyway, and then, you know, once you do that, the last thing is promote it. And you've got to promote it. The books, there are so many books out there, books will not sell themselves. You're going to have to go to online forums. You're going to have to look into advertising. You're going to have to look at, sending out PRs. You're going to have to promote the book over and over again. You're going to be sick of talking about it, but, you know, to everybody out there that you reach, that's, you know, part of your demographic that hasn't heard of it, that's a potential customer out there. So I think I've pretty much covered what I know about writing a book, which I hope that some of it you'll find useful. And Invading Spaces goes on sale August 9th. You can get it in person at OVGE in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you want more information on that show, if you're anywhere around Tulsa, if you're in Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, Dallas, Northern Texas, any of those places like that, it's well worth going out there. Go to OVGE.com, or you could go to my website, RobOHara.com, and go to the photo album. And I have pictures from OBGE 2003, 4, 5, and 6. And you can look at the pictures. If you look at those pictures and you like old computers or video games or anything like that, I guarantee you'll be coming out to the show. It's a blast. There's going to be lots of members of the Digital Press forums, the Atari Age forums. There's a lot of people from those places that come. There'll be some people from the Oklahoma Coin-Op Collectors Forum. So, I mean, it's a big full-day Saturday party. Come out and buy, sell stuff, play video games, all that, and obviously, and buy copies of the brand-new Invading Spaces book, which I'll be autographing there. And then after that, I will have copies once I get back. I'll put them on sale on the 9th, but they probably won't ship out until the 11th, but I'll be selling copies through the website as well, and I'm already starting to do the work to get it through Amazon again. So anyway, that's it. I'm going to wrap this one up. Episode 108 should air on August 15th, and the topic of that show is going to be video game shows, and I'll be talking about how the show went in Tulsa and some of the other shows I went to and stories about that kind of stuff. So hopefully that one will be on time and a little bit shorter than this one. With that, I'm going to wrap this one up. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I will see you either in Tulsa on the 9th or back here on the podcast on August 15th. Thanks for listening, and flack out.